Blog Talk Radio.
Once again, Faint Strings of the Original Onions, a nifty band here from the Northeast Ohio area. Welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kaye from Spook Show, and I'm here with...
You're playing a weirdish, really bad movie. And we have a very special guest tonight. We're Rich Helmenfels, retired from the Beacon Journal Pop Culture Critic. Also does a mailbag still for the Beacon, and as well as a syndicated column for the Tribune on questions and answers about movies and television. Rich, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
You know, before we, I came up with the topic by our last week's show when we did this on Claude Rains, and Dale was complaining about a movie he thought should have been the Oscar winner. And then I contacted you and talked to Dale about it before the awards even happened on Sunday. And so this did not have anything to do with necessarily the big mix-up at the awards. But Rich, you watch a tremendous amount of live awards programs and such. Are there a lot of things that happen like this throughout?
Not a lot. There have been mistakes. There was John Travolta mispronouncing Idina Menzel's name a few years ago. There was, of course, if you count in things like the Super Bowl halftime show, there's the Janet Jackson incident. If you go back to the early years of live TV drama and all of that, there were a lot of famous bloopers. Guys were supposedly dead getting up and walking away when, you know, they thought they were off camera and they weren't. I think it's in No Time for Sergeants that Andy Griffith is, you know, soaking wet in one scene, and the next scene that's taking place days later, he's still soaking wet because, again, they didn't have time for him to change his shirt. So we run into glitches like this, but certainly what happened with the Oscars was one of the more spectacular ones. And, you know, I mean, most people, I think, they heard La La Land, they turned off their sets and went to bed, and then everything went crazy.
How do you, how
kind of funny,
do you
Warren
make that?
Warren Beatty just wanted to go there. Yeah. They handed him the wrong envelope. And Warren Beatty obviously saw it was the wrong thing because he must have read the entire thing and said,
he said Emma Stone, you know, best actress, La La Land, and a number of people have written about it. It's very difficult, especially in a situation like that, to say, I'm confused or there's something wrong. And, you know, he was hoping someone would notice his being perplexed and do something about it, and they didn't. And then Faye Dunaway just saw the movie title and read it off, because, again, as you said, they'd been handed the wrong envelope, and the fellow who handed the envelope isn't working for the Oscars anymore.
How do you make that right? That's so difficult for both La La Land and the actual winner.
It's you can't make it right. What was unfortunate is apparently there were things in place that if a mistake was made, someone was supposed to hurry on the stage and let them know a mistake had been made before somebody gets up there and starts accepting. Because what happened in this case, as you know, is several of the producers from the show had given their acceptance speeches before this is straightened out. Everything's going crazy. The poor folks from Moonlight are trying to give their acceptance, but nobody's really thinking about that again. So what could have been a great moment for them was really kind of lost in this error. And it's too bad because Moonlight's a really great movie.
I really love what Steve Harvey did after the what he tweeted out afterwards. Did you see that?
Yeah, remind me.
Well, he tweeted out, Warren, tweet me. I can help you through this.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the immediate reactions with Steve Harvey, you know, because the Miss Universe thing was, you know, no longer the blooper king of the world. And, you know, he had, of course, had, I think, saved John Travolta's reputation for a few years. But it's Now it's on the guys from PricewaterhouseCooper about this malfunction, you know?
Except, but who are they going to remember? They're not going to remember Pricewaterhouse. They're going to remember the Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Rich, the reason this whole thing came up is what I was griping about. I'll recap this somewhat humorous story from my own life. Myself and my children are fans of the Indiana Jones franchise, and we went to go see the Crystal Skull movie a few years ago.
Yeah.
Theater.
Yeah.
And I was telling them how enraged I was that Chariots of Fire had beaten the original Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981. I said, geez, where's the Chariots of Fire lunchboxes and action figures? You know what I mean?
Right.
Not that those things alone would determine an Oscar winner. You know, you do have to look at the artsy aspects. But ironically, while we were waiting for Plastic Skull, the movie theater starts playing the theme from Chariots of Fire to mock me.
They knew you were there. They heard
you. It felt like it. But there is a page of Academy Awards winners here on the internet, and they do list that as one of the faux pas, not necessarily because of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but there were other good films too, like Reds and On Golden Pond in 81.
Well, the Academy has its own reasons for the pictures that it votes for, and it's not necessarily because of their popularity or their box office success. As an old theory, I always called the Chamber of Commerce theory, that I think applies to most awards, where they want to give the prizes to things that they think make them look good, that make them look serious and thoughtful and prestigious. So many years, if you look at the box office successes, or even the relative success at the box office of the movies that managed to get nominated, the winners tend to be the smaller films because they, in some way, they encourage values or thought or prestige, and the Academy voters like that.
Who chooses movies, Rich, that get nominated?
Okay, well, I've been reading up on the process, and your listeners can read about it even more on Oscars.org. It's a very complicated process. It starts with movies that have been shown in LA for at least 7 days during the calendar, 7 consecutive days during the calendar year. They have to be at least 4. We're talking about feature films. There were 336 films that were eligible this year. Now, those films then are submitted. The ones that are going for the Oscars are submitted by the film's owners, you know, their distributors, their studio, or whatever, for the various categories. Then within the categories, say the cinematographers decide who to nominate for cinematography, the actors decide who to nominate for acting, and so on, through a weighted system where you basically not only list the ones you think you should be nominated, but you list them in order of preference. So there's kind of a point system at work there. But in, say, in one of the smaller branches of the Academy, it might be 50 people who are deciding whether something gets a nomination or not. You know, there's a percentage system that works on that. It's an insanely complex process. And then finally, that just gets you the nominees. And in most categories, you only have 5 nominees. Some time ago, they changed the Best Picture nomination category so it could be up to 10. And partly a response to what you guys are concerned about, which was that the big commercial films, such as, say, The Dark Knight, were not getting nominated. So they thought, okay, we'll broaden the base, we'll take more nominees, and maybe some of those bigger pictures will get in. People will be more interested in the Oscars. They'll be more likely to watch the TV show, all of that sort of thing. But it hasn't really panned out as well, I think, as they thought, that it still tends to be artsier films that get nominated as opposed to, say, your Guardians of the Galaxy or your Indiana Jones or something like that. That's not to say the pictures that get nominated are bad, but it's just to say that there are certain thought processes that go on in this. And, of course, then you get into sentiment and all that. Because of all this,
I can understand that, how they want to reward you know, the pictures that aren't doing that are good films, but really not getting the press or not getting the attention, or the airspace or something. But on the other hand, they're also, in a way, I guess, handicapping. Maybe that's why they have people's awards and other things like that. But, you know, the movies that people do like and do go to see, that kind of handicaps them. If they're a successful film, there's a lot of things they're not going to be eligible for when it comes for the actual Oscars.
I think it depends on the film, of course. I mean, something like, say, a Transformers is not something that most people, I think, would consider as an Oscar-worthy film, as popular and, you know, as it is in a lot of ways. Lord of the Rings,
right,
though, is something that was treated seriously by them. I think, you know, something like The Dark Knight should have gotten more attention than it did. The other thing, of course, and you guys are certainly very aware of this, is certain genres are not held in high esteem by the voters either.
Good. I wanted to discuss that with you.
Some in certain categories, comedy doesn't always do well. And you go through periods where, say, the big epic movie is the one that gets all the attention. And partly, again, I think because it makes a lot of jobs. But so, say, a Gandhi beats E.T. and Tootsie and The Verdict because it's got that big thing happening, and at that point the Academy liked it. I mean, we could talk about some of these really strange choices that have been made, but it comes down to roughly 6,000 people who vote for this that make these decisions. Now, as you know, last year there was a huge controversy over the lack of people of color being nominated for acting awards. So the Academy shook up its voting base as a result of that. They were concerned that particularly there were a lot of older voters who weren't as active in the film industry as they had been. They kind of moved them to an emeritus status where they couldn't vote anymore. They brought in a new group to vote, and we saw this year a tremendous amount of diversity, well-deserved in many cases, in the nominations.
Well, sometimes it's good to have
approximately 6,000 people. Those are the people who vote on these five.
Those are the people
entries,
who nominate
right?
and vote. Yeah, yeah. It's about 6,000.
Okay. How much? Because I have went through a Wall Street Journal article here. Just a straw poll of the Wall Street Journal, and anything that's out there considered Oscar worthy is going to be able to be seen in New York. We would have to go to Cedar Lee to see half these movies. You know, but
well,
in New York, it's going
to
be there.
A lot of them down here in Akron too.
They did. But when in this poll that the straw poll that they had here for the nominees, the three most seen, they said, "Have you seen Arrival?" 52.8% said yes. 47.2% said no. La La Land. 49.1% said yes. 50.9% said no. It keeps going down. Hell or High Water. 43.6% said yes, 56.4% said no. Moonlight, 24.1% said they saw the movie, 75.9% said yes. The Follow Lion, 23.7% did, 76.5% didn't. And then Fences, 16.5% did, and 83.5% didn't see Fences. Are those 6,000 that are making these decisions, do you think they – do you see all the films?
It depends on the category. In a number of the branches, you're obligated to have seen, say, documentary. You're obliged to have seen the films before you can vote on them. So they have that in place. And again, the rules are set up so that to be eligible, a film has to have been shown in Los Angeles for the 7-day period sometime in the calendar year. So it's not their concern whether it's been seen in Cleveland or Akron or Cincinnati or any place like that, that they're still, you know, a hometown industry to a certain degree. Now, in some categories, they've got to be shown, say, in Los Angeles and New York, but it's not saying these are films that are widely distributed. There are years when the nominations are announced, and there are films on that list that haven't played in, you know, Northeast Ohio yet. And
so it's possible that a small independent film could win, maybe?
It could, sure. I mean, some films that have been nominated are considered to be independence, something like Spotlight last year, or again, Moonlight, although it got into a lot of theaters, is in a lot of ways what we would think of as an independent film. So is Elle, the French film that had a Best Actress nomination this year, which, again, was not around here very long. There are a lot of these things that, again, the people in the industry know about them. They've maybe seen them at festivals or they've gotten reviewed, you know, contender disc or this kind of thing. But it's not like the everyday moviegoer who can necessarily see all of these.
Thus comes the surprise at the end of the night, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make a big difference, you think, as to when the movie is released? That you think they'll hold back movies till closer to the end of
yeah.
the year?
If you look at release dates, frequently you'll see it's top heavy with films near the end of the year. That Oscar season, Oscar nomination season is in many cases November, December. You know, post Thanksgiving through New Year's, you'll usually see quite a few nominees at that time. Some may be from earlier in the year, but if they're earlier in the year, it's a good chance that even the voters have forgotten about them. If it's, so they like to stack them right around the time people are filling out their ballots.
So the last thing you see is the first thing you remember.
Well, isn't that the case in most things?
Yeah.
I can tell you what I had for dinner tonight. I don't know if I can tell you what I had 2 days ago.
Rich, do you have any particular films of say, in recent years, say the last, 30, 40 years, do you have any particular films that you thought the Oscars kind of got wrong, and versus some maybe you feel that they got dead on, they hit it spot on?
I don't object to Moonlight winning Best Picture. I thought Manchester by the Sea was the best of that group, but I said this before the Oscars, I wasn't going to complain if Moonlight or Arrival or a couple other films had won. I was just frankly glad La La Land didn't win because I thought La La Land was kind of slight. La La Land, in fact, reminded me of, you want to talk about times they got it wrong, The Artist not too many years ago, which won Best Picture and a whole bunch of other Oscars, and which I thought was a really, really sort of trivial film in a lot of ways. And it beat, for instance, Moneyball for Best Picture. It beat The Descendants, which is a picture I've seen many times, for Best Picture. And that, to me, was one of the slights. You know, going back some years, I mentioned, Gandhi over E.T. and Tootsie. Saving Private Ryan, one of the all-time great films, lost to Shakespeare in Love, and people still shake their heads over that. if you go back through the years, let's go back to when there's a film that's not terribly well-remembered called The Greatest Show on Earth from the 50s.
Yes.
That beat High yeah. Noon and beat The Quiet Man. Citizen Kane, a consistent, one of the great American films of all time. Lost
yeah.
to How Green Was My Valley, another wonderful film, but that was a year where The Maltese Falcon and Sergeant York and Suspicion were all also nominated. So it's easy to look at these and go, wait, no, that's just wrong. I mean, and I can look at the actor categories where, again, Ben Kingsley and Gandhi beat Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie and Paul Newman in The Verdict. Art Carney in Harry and Tonto beat Dustin Hoffman in Lenny, Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, and Al Pacino in The Godfather Part Two.
Holy cow. Yeah, and, that's a mess.
Yeah, and that was a point, again, where there was a real generational divide in the Academy, and older voters were not as welcoming of some of these great young actors that were coming up at that time. Jack Lemmon in a movie, again, not well-remembered, called Save the Tiger, beat Al Pacino in Serpico. So,
wow.
Yeah, this stuff happens all. I mean, I'm sure you guys have some of these that you look at and go, what happened as well?
Well, in a lot of cases, rightfully so, in many of the years, particularly, I think, a good deal of the 1950s, but it seems that horror, science fiction, and fantasy films often, especially earlier on, got great slights in the Motion Picture Academy Awards.
Yes. Part of that, I think, that horror films frequently were you know, more modest, you know, they were like B films to a lot of people. They were genre pieces. They were commercial, but they weren't thought of as anything much more than commercial. As much as, say, we look now at a Frankenstein or Dracula and see the artistry in it, at the time, I think they were just thought of as lesser films. Besides Silence of the Lambs, you know, what's the last great horror? You know, what great horror films have done well with the Academy?
Yeah.
You know. And
until they started coming out with special effects awards and so forth. Really, the entire industry wasn't getting a lot of notice. I think, did not Frederick March maybe get nominated for Jekyll
for
and Hyde?
For Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I think so. But again, we have to sort of poke around to find these examples. I mean, I even think with Silence of the Lambs, you're kind of stretching the definition of horror to count it.
Yeah.
But that's about as close as you get in a lot of cases. And, you know, I read a lot of critics who, you know, look at the reaction right now to Get Out, look at the reaction to It Follows. You know, there are horror films that are being quite acclaimed, but I think it's still tough for the Academy to get over that hump. Same thing with, you know, movies derived from comic books, you know, that are films I particularly like. I think the new Wolverine movie, Logan, is really good. But some people are already saying, "Oh, it should get Oscar nominations." I'll be a little surprised if that happens. And we can talk about that a year from now.
Yeah, sure. Do you have any favorite years for films?
Favorite years for films?
Where there were just a lot of good movies in one particular year.
Well, I just mentioned, you know, 1941. You know, I mean, I love old movies and how many good things there were that year. 1939, you know, where you had Gone with
year.
The Wind and Mr. Smith and all these other films that you had a huge number of pictures that we now consider classics that were all, you know, all coming in theaters at once. But again, you know, there are years where there's neglect, even if you go back a ways. I was watching Singing in the Rain the other night, and it was not nominated for Best Picture its year. But it's considered one of the great films now, and it was overlooked.
Musicals have a tough road with that, though, don't they?
It depends on the musical.
I mean,
again, La La Land won, what was it, 6 Oscars this year, and it's a de facto musical in certain respects. I mean, it's the kind of thing that people think of in that way. But Singing in the Rain, again, was nominated in the 1952 Oscars that were won by The Greatest Show on Earth. It was not nominated, excuse me. And what was nominated besides Greatest Show was High Noon, Ivanhoe, Moulin Rouge, and The Quiet Man. There's some pretty good movies in there, but, you know, Singing in the Rain is, you know, inarguably a classic, and the Academy didn't see the merit of it.
It's
why do you
it's
think
hard
the Academy?
To... Go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say, why do you think the Academy never did get one to Hitchcock with all the great movies that so many of them become classics?
Yeah, I was looking at a list of the years he was nominated, because he was nominated 5 times for Best Director. Psycho lost basically to The Apartment, the Billy Wilder film, and the Academy loved Billy Wilder, and I love The Apartment. Rear Window was up the year of On the Waterfront, tough year. Spellbound was up against The Lost Weekend, a film I don't think that has held up as well. Lifeboat, when he did Lifeboat, he lost to Going My Way, and Rebecca lost to The Grapes of Wrath. So you could argue at least 3 of those years, there were films that were, you know, and directors who were as good or better as Hitchcock who were working. But I think beyond that, I don't know that he was really thought of as someone in the Hollywood community, you know, who the way, say, a John Ford or a Leo McCarey or a Billy Wilder was, And I think that sometimes works against him too. And again, if he's working more on the scary side of the street, if he's doing something like a Psycho, that's going to unsettle a lot of voters in the Academy. It's astonishing
that he did not actually.
I'm sorry, but one of the things, you know, they do, the Academy does do these kind of make goods, where you get an honorary Oscar or you get the Thalberg Award or something like that. And I believe Hitchcock finally got one of, you know, was honored in that respect. But the fact that he made so many amazing films and did not ever win for Best Director is certainly something you can fault the Academy for.
Because I think of, you know, Stranger from a Train and North by North on the Train, it's North by Northwest, and it was wonderful, wonderful Hitchcock films.
Yeah.
Just so many of his. He didn't do a ton of films, but the ones he did, outside of Family Plot, were all pretty special films.
Hey, I saw Family Plot in the theater when it came out.
So did I, and I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was a fun movie.
I mean, it was what, Bruce Dern and Barbara Harris, Hitchcock.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought Frenzy,
Karen Black,
Frenzy was a pretty great picture too, and that was fairly late in his career. But that's one that really, I think, probably unsettled people and, you know, voters in the Academy.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we talk about people who never got their due, Hitchcock is certainly one. You look at Peter O'Toole, wonderful actor, nominated I think 7 times, never won. Again, was given a special honorary Oscar, and yet never won the competitive prize. Paul Newman went years without winning one, and finally, again, I think it was sort of a make good when he did finally win for Color of Money, because a lot of people thought he should have won for The Verdict, you know, several years before that. Look at all the films Pacino did before he finally won. There are these terrific actors that somehow or other just could not break through with the Academy. And as I said, you know, Pacino lost to, among others, Art Carney and Jack Lemmon. That's no knock on those guys as actors, but they were not giving the level of performances that Pacino was.
Yeah. And again, my opinion's a little slanted here, but sometimes they get it right, too. One of my personal heroes is a special effects man who worked on films that really wouldn't compete with other films released. Ray Harryhausen, a stop-motion animator.
Sure. Yeah,
when they gave him the Lifetime Achievement Award for his efforts, because he did change the industry, even though the films weren't really as artsy as the films who actually won the years he released his films. I think they did him right, and fortunately it wasn't posthumously either, you know, so he could appreciate it while he was alive.
Yeah, I mean, there are always those, you know, on the technical side, there are people who, that's why they have the technical awards. These guys are part of the industry, too. They're part of what makes films, you know, makes a film a film, and it's important to recognize them. And yes, I know everybody wants to go have a sandwich during that long stretch between, you know, the two best supporting winners on the telecast while they're giving out the tech awards, but you take them away, and it takes something away from a lot of the movies that we talk about.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge part of the storytelling process.
Yeah, and Harryhausen was a legend. So.
Yeah, and unfortunately, his predecessor and mentor was not recognized, Willis O'Brien, but, you know, it's to his credit, and sometimes the Academy does get it right with things like that. And again, my opinion slanted because of the genre, but
right.
And I
most years I have at least one category where I'm going, what the heck happened? This year for Best Actress, I thought Amy Adams should have been in it for Arrival. I thought Taraji P. Henson should have been in it for Hidden Figures. Neither one was nominated. So you get into these situations that where, again, when you only have in most categories 5 nominees, inevitably out of, you know, 336 films, people are going to get left out. You know, and then there are the,
Yeah, that's true.
And you guys are aware that, that there are people whose nominations get taken away from them from time to time, right?
No.
Tell us.
There are very strict rules at the Oscars about campaigning for awards and campaigning for nominations. And you can't, for instance, call up your friends in your division of the Academy and say, hey, I'm up for a nomination. Could you, you know, give me a bump, without running into trouble with the Academy? And it happened again this year in one with one would-be nominee whose honor was rescinded because they discovered that he was campaigning. Now, before that, you know, you get those four-year consideration ads and all that, but there are rules against specifically lobbying individuals to vote for you. And
it happened
not too long ago with one of the, I think with a best song nominee, that the same kind of thing was going on. So then the Academy sends out a release and says, you know, that guy's not nominated anymore.
Wow.
But they're allowed to advertise and put up billboards. As far as I know, billboards, but I know they can put ads in the trade magazines and things like that.
Yeah, they can do
it. How is that different?
Apparently, they think that the more direct one-on-one campaigning is wrong when that isn't. And, you know, I don't know what their logic is on that, but that's how they work that.
Would they be afraid that they'd be, like, trying to bribe the people, or if you're doing it on an individual basis?
Well, there have been questions with some awards about whether, you know, whether inappropriate actions were taken in terms of kissing up to people in the people kissing up to folks because of that, yeah. You know, that suddenly you're having, and this came up a number of times with the Golden Globes, for instance, that fancy dinners were being thrown for potential voters and all sorts of that kind of lobbying. But then the Golden Globes seem to be a lot more relaxed in their standards than the Oscars are.
Hey, I have an interesting question here. Just for, you know, Dale and I were on a panel on horror hosting back at the MonsterFest Mania in Akron last
uh-huh.
night. And one thing came up talking to Mike McGrainer, who was producer for Fritz the Night Owl, was that
uh-huh.
the Academy Award statuette really still belongs to the Academy. You can have it, and you can have place, but if they catch you misdisplaying it or posing with it in a strange way, something, they can actually come and take your Academy Award or your television award away from you. Is that the same with the Oscar, or that it doesn't really? It belongs to them, but it can be taken away. It technically belongs to the Academy.
I think in terms of something like posing for it in an ad or whatever, that the Academy probably has a copyright on the image or a trademark on the image, so that would protect it. There have been times over the years when people have tried to pawn their Oscars, and the Academy has restricted that. But I think I'm looking at a story right now that they lost a court challenge apparently not too many years ago. Let's see, when was this? This was actually earlier this year that somebody had tried to pawn their Oscar and took the Academy to court and was able to continue to do it.
Mm.
But and there have been some fairly sad cases at times of people trying to do that with their Oscars. Harold Russell had to pawn one or both of his Academy Awards at one time. So I think the Academy has tied up whatever rights it can to protect the use of its image, even to the point of that you have to be careful about how you refer to their programming and all of that. It's not unlike the thing with the Super Bowl, where the Super Bowl actually owns the phrase, the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you'll see a lot of promos. Yeah, the big game. Yeah. If I'm doing a Super Bowl connected pizza sale, for instance. I can't necessarily say in my ad, hey, come get your pizza, you know, your Super Bowl pizza. I would have to say, come get your pizza before the big game. Because the Super Bowl is tied up.
That seems a little funny, but yeah, okay. You see it all the time with the working with the ads and stuff, even with grocery stores and stuff. Get ready for the big game.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of
NFL is a powerful.
I guess they're. Hey Dale, do we want to mention the people in the chat room? Maybe open up the phone lines to other people that want to join in.
Sure, Rich. Do you mind if we take some callers?
I'm happy to take the calls. Go ahead.
Excellent. We've got a gentleman who's been waiting quite some time to join us. Hi, welcome to Erie House Radio.
Hello,
caller.
Yes, this is King Charles.
Hey, King.
Hey. I have a question, and I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, okay? But
here it comes.
No.
It's like starting off, to be perfectly honest.
No, I'm not criticizing any of you. What I'm criticizing is the fact that, let's face it, Hollywood panders to popularity. Okay? Now, as you've mentioned before, you know, films have been awarded the Oscar that, personally, to me, were junk. Okay? That, and this is coming from a person who, the last film that I watched actually in a movie theater was in 1992. Okay.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
You're worse than me.
The ratio of films that I watch in terms of black and white as to things that are in color with surround sound and all this other kind of garbage. Let me ask you this. Do you think that the Academy is kind of trending towards making these in our sense of what is a good performance, that it trivializes a good performance against a film that is popular?
I
would argue, as we've talked about all along, that sometimes, and I don't think it's particularly a new trend, but sometimes certain kinds of films, many of which would be popular, are not held in as high regard by the Academy voters as they might be with moviegoers generally. And we've talked about how, again, you know, horror can get overlooked even if it's immensely popular. Comedy frequently can get overlooked, even though it's often an immensely popular form. So if you are giving a really great performance in one of these these categories of films, it may be that the Academy, it doesn't take it as seriously. It may also be, though, that you're giving that great performance in a film that the Academy has paid more attention to than the public at large. You take something like Viggo Mortensen in Captain Fantastic, which was, you know, not in theaters very long, was in fact on DVD before the Oscars were announced. Hell or High Water, the same thing. Movies with some pretty darn good performances that were acknowledged, but they were something the Academy had seen that maybe the public at large hadn't. So, yeah, sure, sometimes good things get overlooked, particularly in popular films.
Let me pose another question.
But I don't think that's something new. I think that's been common through much of the history of the movies.
Well, that brings up my next question, is some one person, one film, one technical person, so on and so forth, wins an award. Now, since there are five nominees at the end of the process, suppose they gave the awards to the top three or the top five even, wouldn't that make it more, to me, a bit more democratic? Okay, you've got the people that like a popular film because it fills theater seats, okay? Because that's where Hollywood goes. It's like, okay, which one made the most money, all right? And that's when you get drunk.
Except, you know, the ones that make the most money, as we said, aren't necessarily the ones that the Academy thinks reflect best on the films. But in terms of just giving them to the top three, that's just not something we do as a culture. We don't say, okay, the two best NFL teams each get a Super Bowl.
But
we don't say the Indians get half of the World Series, or what do we want to say, 3/7 of a World Series championship.
That's completely different.
We tend as a culture in competitive events to pick a winner.
Right. That to me is the what would you call it? The difference between yes, there is one Super Bowl champion. Okay, that's the way it works. Okay, but in films, to me, it's not the same. Okay, when you say this is the best picture of the year, to me, that's a very gray area. All right,
mm-hmm.
And that's why I say that. Okay, get away from the sports stuff. Okay, you're the best team at hockey or baseball or, you know, whatever it may be. Which are the films that people need to know that, hey, these are good films because, you know, even though, you know, maybe they weren't shown in L.A. or this or that or whatever the requirements are.
Here's how I can answer that for you, Tom. King. Anything like this is art, and art is always going to be subjective. What you like, I may not like, and what I like, you may not like. Maybe we agree on two things, but Dave and Rich like something else. And the Academy is the Academy.
That's exactly my point.
And they have to pick one winner, but I think throughout the due process of having the other nominees, each does get honored and each does get brought to the viewers at large. So maybe they're exposed to some films that they didn't even know existed. That, in my own myopic view, being a fan of the genre as I am, I still will go outside and see if a film win something or become popular for some other reason that maybe I don't identify with, but I become curious, see it, and agree that it is, in fact, a very good and artsy film.
I agree.
It's because of this gray area that you even have the opportunity to have discussions like what we're having. Otherwise, you know, why bother to have the awards? Everybody knows what is the best.
Well, to follow up, you know, to some degree on the earlier point, you still do have five nominees, or for Best Picture, you have, you know, this year 9 nominees. So people can go, okay, this may be some of the best. And there may be a chance for them to go out and see those films that they might not have thought about otherwise because of that. Moonlight, I think, went back into 1,500 theaters this weekend because of the Oscar win. And so people who maybe had not seen it before suddenly have a chance to take a look at it. It may also be that, you know, the Oscars are not the only award that's out there that people may discover things, or honors are coming through the Golden Globes or the Independent Spirit Awards or other places that say, okay, there are disagreements about what the best film is. And there are other places that films can be nominated, you know, can be honored. New York Film Critics Circle, you know, a lot of these things that give folks a chance to be aware of these other films, even if only one gets to walk away with the Oscar.
Okay.
Of all the different awards shows and such, Rich, which is your favorite? I know that the Oscar is the big one, but which maybe would be your favorite to watch? You find most enjoyable to watch?
I don't find any of them particularly enjoyable. because they're you know, again, it's a sort of a process of we have X number of awards to give, and yet we have to fill 2 to 3 to 4 hours of time so that there will be filler in them. I am most likely to watch the Oscars in a given year. I keep track of what wins, say, the Independent Spirit Awards, but I don't necessarily watch their show. I take a look at what the Golden Globes do, although the Golden Globes are, again, another kettle of fish because they split some of their categories between dramas and comedies so that they can actually give 2 Best Picture Awards there by breaking up the genres.
Well, then
in terms of watching, they're always a chore. Even if they're intermittently amusing, it's still a lot of hours of please, could we just get to the big winners?
Well, then can I ask you this? Given that there are a number of different, you know, awards, like you said, the Golden Globes, Independent Spirit, and so on and so forth, which do you think is the most accurate?
Most accurate
in saying, okay, this is a good film, you know, not just because it got, you know, a whole lot of money. And let's face it, money runs Hollywood. Hollywood produces these shows, or New York, and so on and so forth. Which do you think over the years, particularly in the past, like I said, I don't watch any current films for the last 1992 was the last.
You've missed a lot of good movies.
Well, I might have. I'll tell you this. I watched about 5 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, and I'm sorry, too gory. I literally was watching that with my hand in front of my face as I'm watching people. You know, the guy that, he's talking to this guy, he turns around. The guy's got a bullet in his head. I'm sorry. That's not something I want to watch. So I did not watch the rest of the film. Okay, but my question still remains: which of these awards, do you think is the most accurate in saying this is a good film? And we talked about before, you know, particularly Psycho. Okay, and I don't see how you could, put this up against the, I think you said it was The Apartment that beat that out.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't see how you could take, you know, those two, put them together and say, I mean, please, yes, The Apartment was a funny film, but Psycho is a transcendental film. It defines, a horror in a way that very few, films that I have seen come even close to. So, again, my question is, which do you think is the most accurate?
None of the above.
Okay.
every awards operation makes mistakes. Every group that gives an award, and again, I was involved in the TV Critics Association for a number of years, and I didn't always like what we gave awards to. But the discerning moviegoer, the person who cares passionately about films, is every year going to find something to be disappointed about in every award system that's out there. It's just,
sure.
It's just because,
I think, you know,
because people have their own taste, and it's not necessarily going
right.
to be validated by a group of voters, especially a group that they're not a part of. I mean, look at where we started this conversation, you know, with Indiana Jones, where we talk about horror, and that these are just, if that's your love in film, then you're not going to be very happy most of the time. You didn't like Saving Private Ryan. I thought it was one of the great films. I'm still disappointed that it lost the Oscar.
It was I watched it,
and
it wasn't very good.
Answering your question, what Dale said earlier, King, you know, when he said how this does bring attention to these other films and gives people a chance to find out about them, whether it might be showing in the area or not is another thing, but many times if they have been released or when they get released to DVD, it does give people the opportunity to see these that they might not have ever seen or even heard about had it not been for award shows like this.
Okay, I see that completely, particularly with the onset of online things like Netflix, and I guess I don't have it, but you know things like this where people don't have to run out to a theater, they can watch them at home. But where the question still becomes is where do you get your input from? Okay. How do you even know that this film exists? You know, and I think these award shows, I mean, all of them do serve a purpose, you know, even though I disagree with a lot of them or have no idea what these films are. I mean, in particular this year, if you named all of the people that won or were nominated, I probably wouldn't even recognize a name in that. Okay.
Let that be your impetus, though. I'm sitting here looking at some lists of films that, you know, that I was quite frankly prepping for the show. And 1990 is a real good example. People go back and forth with Dances with Wolves and Goodfellas, both very good films. Now, Goodfellas, anytime it's on my television, if I'm walking by, I stop and I have to watch it. I might not do that with Dances with Wolves because it's a different type of film. I love them both, by the way. But there's other films that came out that year that I was really completely blind to until I started doing this research, like Reversal of Fortune and Miller's Crossing. I'm tempted to watch them now.
Well, that's good. No, I mean, I think it does bring attention, actually, particularly on the side of the technical people. Okay, because, you know, a film is not just the director, it's not just the actors, it's what goes on behind them, you know. And it's a shame, as Mr. Heldenfeld talked about before, that, you know, you get this and then you get what he called filler, where people go out and, you know, they get another beer or, you know, pretty much ignore that. And I think that's a shame because, you know, like I said, movies are not just one thing. They're everything. They're everything that goes into that show.
Well, I just, again, and I'm looking at a list, you know, we were just talking about 1990 and Dances with Wolves beats Goodfellas, which some people object to. There was a great film called The Grifters that year. Not nominated. Reversal of Fortune, not nominated. Longtime Companion, Metropolitan, Postcards from the Edge, all not nominated. And so they were, to some degree, denied the attention that went to some of the ones that were. But people were passionate about some of those other films and went out and saw them and hopefully led to other folks being able to make films because folks had watched theirs. You mentioned streaming.
Well, let me ask you this then. If you could change the process, not just for the Oscars, well, the other shows, some of them it's a popularity contest, okay, as far as I'm concerned. But as far as the Oscars are concerned, which is, you know, kind of the crown jewel, what would you change, if anything, in the process of determining, how the show selects a winner?
Oh, how? Okay, so you're talking about not the show, but the actual voting process.
What?
I think the introduction of the weighted ballot was a good thing. I thought that was a nice move they did, that suddenly you don't just list five films you think are good. You have to determine, you know, an order of preference there, and that can affect who wins. I like that they expanded the number of Best Picture nominees. I would like to see more nominees in the acting categories and some of the other categories as well. There was one of the problems in the system now is you may have 9 pictures nominated for Best Picture, but 4 of those have no chance at a directing nomination because there are only 5 directing nominations. So it would make sense to, if you're going to expand the number of picture nominations, to expand in some of the other key categories, you know, writing, directing, cinematography, so that if there are really worthwhile films there, they get another chance to be nominated. Of course, then we're talking about a 5-hour TV show just reading all the nominees. But I think that would be a positive step in terms of addressing, I think, at least some of the concerns about whether films get recognized or not. Some of the rules are just there. I think, you know, the film has to be shown in Los Angeles is it's a rule that sort of makes sense. I'm not as convinced by the rule that says that if a movie has shown on television before it's in a theater, then it's not eligible, particularly when you consider the quality of some of the films that are being made, particularly for premium channels these days, it might be that it would be better for them to open the tent, you know, open the tent wider in that respect. But, the Academy still wants it to be an honoring, again, of theatrical films. But it would be nice some years to have seen some of the great TV movies to be there to sort of challenge Hollywood and say, all right, we did this, stack it up against what you've been putting in cinemas. And I can think of a couple of cases.
Wouldn't that possibly ruin the TV Academy Awards just for the fact that, like, cable started off, they couldn't compete, so they were Cable Ace Awards. When they got better, all the cable ones, the awards disappeared as they became actually winning more awards than network television did.
Sure, but I mean that's again because the industry changed as well. But I think of something. Well, and again, you take something like the OJ documentary, which was successful this year, but had to again sort of this conceit of putting some of it in a theater before it ran on ESPN to make sure that it was eligible for an Oscar. Pull on an example. People love Rain Man, for instance, and it was a big winner of the Oscars. But there was a TV movie around the same time with James Woods and James Garner called Promise, which was as good or better with a similar theme as Rain Man. It would have been really fun to have seen Promise in the Oscars.
Can you expand on that just a little bit, please? Because I did see Rain Man, thought it was a great film, but I had no idea that the other one even existed.
The other one, James Garner plays a man who has a brother who has problems. The brother's played by James Woods, and he has to figure out how to deal with this situation, and particularly how to continue to pay for his brother's care. And it's a quite touching film. It was, I'm looking up right now what year it was, but I and some of my colleagues had, it was in 1986. We had arguments about, again, whether this was something that was on a par or better than Rain Man.
And it was called The Promise.
What was the name of that?
What was the name of that film, Rich? The name of the film was Promise.
Promise.
It was 1986. James Garner plays a man who inherits his mother's house, but also custody of his younger brother who has schizophrenia and epilepsy. And so he has to suddenly figure out how to take care of his brother, because that is something he had promised to do.
Well, I'm glad I had you on tonight. I want to check that film out. I'm a big James Garner fan myself.
Rich, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We reached an hour. If you want to stick around, we can keep going.
I can hang out for a little bit longer.
That sounds great.
The king is always ready
your...
to talk.
That's good.
Yeah. Shut him up, please. Jeez.
You're in the right place.
No, I would like to thank Mr. Heldenfels for providing a lot of insight into what the process is, because, I mean, just for me, because I don't watch rare, I mean, like I said, the as far as color versus black and white's about 9-1. But I agree. I mean, there are films that are out there that I think are, you know, might be good. But when I got Netflix and, you know, you get a 30-day trial for free, and I went through 30 days and watched all, you know. So, I mean, some of these films literally that, you know, everybody raved about, 10 minutes in, it's like, next. Because you can tell that,
well,
you know, they're... I
you
thought,
have to give
you know, 10 minutes
a
in, I'm not going to watch the rest.
Minutes. You got to give
sorry?
A film more than 10 minutes. You got
well,
to give a film more than 10 minutes,
Kate. I disagree. I mean, sometimes, I mean, well, okay, maybe half an hour. Okay, maybe 10, 20, 30 minutes. I'm not watching the rest of this because this is junk. Okay? It's not well acted. It's pandering to this and that. Or it's just, you know, it's just trivial, you know. And I went through, and believe me, at the end of the 30 days, having gone through probably, you know, 30 or 40, maybe even 50 of these films, it's like, I wouldn't watch the rest of any of this stuff. And that's the thing that concerns me most is that, you know, good films, really good films, you know, get passed by. And it's a popularity contest just because this person, you know, oh, it's and I'm this just I'm not saying this in whatever. Okay, it's by Spielberg. It has to be good. Well, no, it doesn't.
And yet sometimes
yeah.
it is. And yet
no,
Spielberg
I agree.
Is good. And yet Bridge of Spies is good. And you know, Spielberg has made some clunkers. But he has made a fairly large number of good films. Clint Eastwood.
Right. I'm not saying that he's a bad, you know, whatever. But I'm saying that, you know, people think, oh, Spielberg, oh, it must be good, so I have to go see it.
No,
and,
see, I'm not convinced that everyone thinks that way. Particularly younger audiences for whom Spielberg is an old guy. I teach part time at the University of Akron. And just for my own information, I put up on the blackboard in my classes, which are college freshmen, the names of the 9 nominated films for Best Picture this year. And I said, okay, how many saw all 9? You know, no hands went up, went down the thing. At most, they had seen maybe 3, some more commonly 2 or 1, that younger audiences, you know what some of them are excited about is they're excited about Kong Skull Island. That's the movie that they you know that they perk up in talking about. So somebody like you know if like a Spielberg isn't necessarily a brand name that means a lot to them. Fast and the Furious is a brand that means something to them. You know, there's a reason that we're about to get the 8th one of those movies. One of the things that, you know, just to take issue with you, you know, just a little bit, King, I understand what you're saying about how you think that most movies are bad. And there's
no,
a guy named,
I didn't say most.
A guy
I
named,
said a lot.
Okay, but again, you aren't even seeing enough about them to want to see most movies.
No, because, I mean, literally, I mean, people are not going to walk out of theater because they paid their – I couldn't even tell you how much it costs for a ticket to these things. But, I mean, if people are in the theater, you know, they're going to watch it till the bitter end, even if it stinks, you know, and they go out and, you know, they're disappointed.
I was at a movie called Running with Scissors a number of years ago and sat there watching the people leave while the movie was in progress.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Wow.
No kidding.
King, don't cheat yourself. There are some good films out there, some of the new films. I agree with you. I prefer black and white. I think there was more character depth in the old days, but there are some good films being put out. Rich mentioned, you know, Clint Eastwood, not just the actor in the old Westerns, but as a director, he's really blossomed. I loved Gran Torino. I loved Unforgiven.
Flags of Our Fathers.
The boxing movie, Million Dollar Baby. That was a great film.
That's one I've actually, you know, kind of thought about. Unfortunately, it was not on Netflix at the time. But, you know, having seen, you know, and past, okay, I,
Sully
the spaghetti
really
westerns that he did, I thought the first one, what was it, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? I thought that
Fistful
was the
Dollars
very good
was
film.
The first one.
Now, he went on to do, I think it was called Bronco Billy.
Yeah.
Okay. And to me, I loved that film. Okay. Particularly, there was a piece at the end where he goes in to, you know, look at the people that are going to make the new tent that was destroyed. And, you know, they're making it out of American flags. And he goes in there, and the people who are actually doing the work just kind of stare at him with, you know, just kind of complete misunderstanding. They're doing their jobs. They're doing what they're told, but they don't understand him. But he understands that they don't understand him. And I thought that was a very powerful scene in a movie that, okay, the one with the, was that, I don't know if there was the chimpanzee in it or not.
Any Which Way But Loose and Every Which Way You Can. There were two of them.
The Slide the Orangutan, yes.
Yeah. But I thought that, I mean, seriously, I thought that Bronco Billy was a, you know, in terms of the story, the actors, the performances, this is something that I doubt it was even considered by the Academy because it was, you know, I don't know. I mean, was it ever nominated? Was it?
My recollection would be no, but
okay.
It's a movie I liked when I saw it at the time. It's not major Eastwood, but it's good Eastwood. But again, here's a guy who, you know, this year he had, you know, last year he had Sully, which was an extremely well-made film. I mean, he's still on top of his directing game. Again, not everything works. Not everything is great. You know, J. Edgar was not a successful movie in a lot of ways, but he can still do a lot of things. I keep thinking of, you know, what's sometimes called Sturgeon's Law, after the great writer Theodore Sturgeon, the sci-fi writer,
yeah,
who when told that you know 90% of science fiction was garbage, Sturgeon's reply was 90% of everything is. And I think that, you know, I think our job is always to find that other 10%, whether
yeah,
it's movies or TV or anything.
No, there's some truth in that, and there's films that I absolutely adore. I love. I could watch them a million times, but deep in my heart, I know that they're not Oscar worthy. I have
mm-hmm.
a personal connection with those particular films. I have a particular affinity to either its genre or maybe certain actors or effects persons or whatever. But I know that they're really not Oscar worthy.
Sure. I mean, my wife and I originally bonded over the movie Roadhouse, Patrick Swayze.
Yeah.
Not something that was considered for Oscars. But it was a movie that for to a varying degrees we both loved, and it was something that still a connection between the two of us.
Okay, given that, then I think that there are films that entertain you, but there are films that make you think. I think that sometimes, you know, making the two come together are difficult, you know. But, I mean, if a film does both, I think that's fantastic. But it doesn't have to do both. You know, maybe you just want to sit down and, you know, laugh for a while. Say it's a comedy or something mm-hmm. that makes you actually think, you know. And these are, to me, two separate categories that when they come together, I think are, you know, it's like, well, then that's Oscar material. Okay.
Not yeah, but then you eliminate, if you do that, then you're eliminating most of your comedies and musicals from attaining an Oscar because they are there to entertain. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to get a great performance out of a Some Like It Hot or something like that.
I disagree.
That deserves some kind of attention.
I disagree. Because there are films like, for example, The Sunshine Boys, okay? The film was extremely funny, but it still made you think, okay? And these are the kind of films that I think deserve Oscars, not just or Golden Globes or, you know, whatever. These are the kind of films that, you know, and I have to say that, frankly, I find them very rare. Because, I mean, it's not like I want to sit down there and, you know, start, you know, having to think about everything. Sometimes you just want to be entertained. But, you know, when it comes together, when both are done, that's what I think is a great film. That's just my opinion. And
I'm looking at the list of Best Picture nominees. I was immensely entertained by Arrival, and it's a very thoughtful film. I had some mixed feelings about Fences, but it's a thoughtful film and one that has entertained a lot of people. Hidden Figures, very, very entertaining and with a message. Hacksaw Ridge, although, again, if you thought Saving Private Ryan was gory, you don't want to see this. Has a compelling story and wants the audience to think about a lot of things about faith and military commitment and all that. Lion surprised me with how moving and engaging it was, and again, about a lot of issues. Manchester by the Sea, and again, some of these, we're not talking about lighthearted comedies here, but we're talking about movies that I sat there lost in for a couple of hours and had plenty of things to think about and feel about at the end, and the same thing with Moonlight. Other people have, you know, seen La La Land as very entertaining. It's certainly the lightest of these, and can see a message in there kind of about Hollywood and all of that, but it's you know, it's not the one I would have picked as the best of that lot, and yet there are others there that I think meet both your criteria.
Okay. No, I think that's the value
of the answer is to get Netflix, King, and watch.
Well, unfortunately, these days, Netflix alone isn't going to do it.
Okay, because that's the one that they promote.
You've got Hulu.
But I don't know what the other ones are.
Yeah.
Can you recommend something that's better?
Well, Amazon Video has quite a few of these things. Hulu is getting into the game, particularly in terms of originals as well. There are some more specialized services such as Acorn TV, which deals with a lot of British productions.
Yeah,
and
Acorn I have.
And you have things like HBO Go that allow you to see their, you know, the HBO productions in a number of different platforms. But you know, the catch in all this is that there are fees attached to most or all of them in some way.
Or you find a younger person that knows how to hack.
To me, I don't mind spending a couple extra bucks, but I want to find what I want to watch. And like I said, when I went through Netflix, I had a 30-day trial, and every day I watched one or two, possibly three, maybe even four movies. But like I said, a half hour in, you know, I said, you know, this is not grabbing me.
Here's another suggestion, King. If you have a modern television, the Roku sticks are not that expensive. My son got me one for Christmas, and I love it. There's channels I know that you would love because they specialize in old films, but there's other channels that show films that are maybe only five or even 2 or 3 years old. And you know, there's no monthly fee. It just comes in through the Roku stick and the internet. You know, whatever kind of Wi-Fi you might have in your home, if you do.
Okay. No, see, that's good to know. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a throwback to, you know, having grown up with, you know, a number of films that I watch, and you know, it's what we talked about actually in various shows, timelines. My timeline
yeah.
goes back a
and
lot.
You can select. They have a million channels to select from. They some of them are by genre. If you like westerns, if you like sci-fi and horror, if you like dramas, if you like police and crime stories, there's all kinds of genres they cover. And do yourself a favor, though. Give some of these newer films, just give them a little chance. There is
okay.
some good ones out. And but I'm very much like you. I prefer the old stuff, but.
Because you never know when there might be something that's really special that does come along, you know. And I hate to think, wow, just because I'm a little bit old-fashioned, if you even want to use the term, that I've missed something that's really, really good. So I do appreciate the value of the Oscars, you know, in alerting the public.
And they do bring your attention. They do bring you attention to some of these films that you might not otherwise ever get the opportunity to hear of. Because, Rich, do these that come to the Oscars, since they're coming more and more from independent places, do they show up in Sundance and the Cannes Film Festival and places like that before they arrive here, or what?
Many of these, yeah, they do have some kind of a window at Sundance or Telluride or Toronto or some of the other festivals. And certainly overseas as well. We get them here. Again, Cedar Lee carries a fair number of them. The Nightlight in Akron carries a fair number of them. I saw a very good documentary at the Nightlight last night, for instance. And some of the multiplexes are getting better at carrying at least a couple of the art films. I mean, I saw Lion at a local, you know, at a local multi-cinema. I've seen some of them. I've gone out to Kent and other places. Most of the, virtually all the Best Picture nominees I saw in a theater around here somewhere. Some of the other categories, it was tougher to catch up to them unless you were really focused on what was on the list. But
so you have seen the Cannes Festival? Can you tell us about it?
No.
I've never been to that. No, I was saying some movies we see here or that are nominated do play the international festivals as well.
Okay.
But I see that
it's
right
not,
now.
It's
you
not
know,
like Akron, Ohio, is the biggest metropolis where these movies all come to, but apparently there's more opportunity than there used to be.
There are, and I think, again, thanks to streaming and other things, particularly when you get into things like documentary categories, there are more options to see these things at home at some point, too.
Well, what do you think was maybe a couple of the strongest years for movies? I know you mentioned the one. I've seen 1994 really had a tremendous amount of really good movies.
Yeah, and again, I
with
Forrest Gump, back, yeah, 1939
Ranking Full and Ordinary People.
Yeah, 1971 is a year people talk about a lot. One of my friends keeps pushing for that year as being a big one. In more recent, again, I thought it was a pretty extraordinary year this year. But 1990, again, we were talking about Dances with Wolves, Godfather 3. Oh well, Goodfellas. You know. What else? The Grifters, Reversal of Fortune. There were a number of things there. Then we get to the next year. You've got Beauty and the Beast, Bugsy, JFK, Prince of Tides, Silence of the Lambs, all nominated. And then when you look at what wasn't nominated, Thelma and Louise, Boys in the Hood, My Own Private Idaho, Barton Fink, La Femme Nikita, Cape Fear, you know, the reboot of Cape Fear, Dead Again. There were a heck of a lot of interesting movies by great filmmakers that year. But the 90s were a pretty good picture there for a while. I'm looking again at just jumping ahead, going through one of my references here. 1992 pictures not nominated included The Player, Malcolm X, Bob Roberts, a movie I was just teaching in my film class, Reservoir Dogs. None of these were nominated for Best Picture.
Wow.
In a year that the nominees were The Crying Game, Few Good Men, Howard's End, Scent of a Woman, and Unforgiven. So you can find those amazing years and a lot of films that maybe didn't get to the Oscars or get to Best Picture, but that were more than worth seeing.
You mentioned 1971 as did you say that was one of your most favorite
years?
That
was a year that one of my friends keeps pushing for around 71.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Okay, 71, the nominees were Clockwork Orange, Fiddler on the Roof, French Connection, Last Picture Show, and Nicholas and Alexandra. Not nominated that year, Dirty Harry, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Carnal Knowledge, Straw Dogs, Play Misty for Me, Bananas, Harold and Maude, you know, again, were not nominated for Best Picture. So that's a pretty awesome year. 72, you have Cabaret, Deliverance, The Immigrants, The Godfather, the first one, and Sounder, all nominated for Best Picture. And Overlook, you had Frenzy, we're back to Hitchcock here, Lady Sings the Blues, Play It Again, Sam, What's Up, Doc, The Ruling Class, Peter O'Toole, one of my favorites. So, like I say, a lot of years you can find a good dozen films just right off the bat that are worth still seeing today.
Where is
yes
your how can I say this? Where can I find that list?
I'm looking at a book called Inside Oscar by Mason Wiley and Damian Bona, and this is an older edition of it that I happen to have on my shelf. But that's one place that you could find it. If you just want to see the nominees in a given year, then, of course, Oscars.org has all of that information. You can go to
another good
a data
site
center.
Called filmsite.org/Oscars,
yeah.
And you can look up
right.
by year the
right.
movies, the actors and actresses.
Okay, no, that's great to know because, like I said, I mean, I'm kind of stuck in the past. But I don't want to ignore the fact that, you know, people do have a lot of imagination and – you hate to say, you know, that here was this great film and you missed it because you dismissed it as, oh, okay, it's, you know, it's the year 2016, 15, whatever. It's probably junk. I don't like to have that attitude. I'm looking for, you know, things that, you know, that I might enjoy.
I think there's a lot you may like. I really appreciate
great.
You guys having me on for this. It's been a lot of fun.
Rich, thank you so much.
Appreciate you taking time out. We know you're still keeping busy. keep writing, please.
All right. Thanks again. Have a good night, everybody.
Rich,
thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Well, that was cool. I learned a lot about the Oscars and the process. That was interesting. To hear about.
Yeah, this has been a tremendous learning process, I think, of the what's out there and what's not. And, you know, I guess it's no shame not to win the Best Picture, and it's a great honor to win it. I think the interesting thing is how they, if you have a very popular film that people have gone to see, you're going to be eligible for a lot of awards, but chances are you're not going to win the Best Picture. And maybe that's to try and give a boost to some of these smaller films and more independent films. And
yeah.
I think that's kind of what we're seeing here.
I did a show here on Erie House about my favorite film year. It has to be 1939, I think. Outside of the genre, you had Gone with the Wind, Dark Victory, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Wuthering Heights, Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, Of Mice and Men, all came out in 1939. Now,
yeah.
In the genre, Oh, my gosh, some of my favorite horror films, the Charles Lofton Hunchback of Notre Dame. You had Son of Frankenstein. I'm forgetting a few right now, but it just really was a great year for films. And that's my favorite.
And that
favorite?
Was in the height of the Depression.
Yeah.
I never really look
year,
at movies by
Dave,
year.
Dave, do you have a favorite year?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello? Okay.
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I don't know. I look at movies by years in generally, so I guess I know what I like, and I guess like King says, I know what I don't. I don't know whether I really have a favorite year for movies. I think it's interesting to see what some of the top movies are in some of the years, and a lot of the movies I like are more along the comedy vein and that type of thing, things that are never, ever, ever going to be considered for a best film. So that's why it's interesting to me to see what scores where sometimes and makes you aware of the different films out there. I can imagine, you know, the wife was looking over the list of the nominees, and there are some she doesn't want to see and some she does want to see, and that's I think, you know, not having to be where Rich is, where he has to talk about this stuff and teach this stuff and write about this stuff. I think that it gives us more leeway to stick with things that we like and not have to sit there and watch things that we might not care for as much, but to try and find. I like what you do, Dale. You look at something, I think it was you that told me, you try to find something good out of everything you watch, even if you don't like it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to sit down.
Oh, I agree. I mean, there's films that I've watched that I didn't particularly think were, you know, great, but there are, you know, maybe some scenes or some whatever that do stick out, you know, and that's kind of unfortunate because, I don't know, maybe it's the director that just couldn't put it together that, you know, you did produce some brilliant scenes, but the rest of it, to me, just was not that good. Does that make sense?
A little.
A little?
I'm still
okay.
Going over 1939 here. This is a list of horror films that's listed on Wikipedia, at least, and they left one out. Buried Alive, The Cat and the Canary, The Dark Eyes of London, which is also known as Human Monster, that's with Bela Lugosi, The Devil's Daughter, The Face at the Window with Todd Slaughter.
Oh,
the Gorilla.
I remember
that, yeah. The Gorilla with the Ritz Brothers, kind of a comedy. The
yeah.
Man They Could Not Hang. The Return of Dr.
Neck.
Son of Frankenstein, Torture Ship. And they left out a crossover. It's not really characterized as a horror film, but Tower of London with Karloff and Basil Rathbone, a great film.
Basil.
Oh, no, don't stop.
Basil.
Car's not here. We got about a minute left,
but
guys.
I'm sorry, it's Basil. I
want to thank you, King, for calling
Basil.
In.
Thank you.
Exactly a minute to go. I want to thank our listeners in the chat that bared with us through the whole time, Evil Annie Ruppert. Gar was in there for a while. Gar, he's probably getting all suited up for his show tonight. And guest 360.
He's having some
technical
trouble, so he's not going to be on there, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
right. Well, he'll be back soon.
Yeah.
Doing his live show. And I'm here with
Dave. I was looking forward to that.
Dave from Weirdness Really Bad Movie, and I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. Thanks for listening, everyone, to Eerie House Radio. Bye-bye. Say bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.